We're on the record now. The meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order at 11:04 on May 26, 2016. With us, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Tilton, Representative Culver, Representative Joseph, Representative Kido, and myself, Chair Olson. Representative Hughes has an excused absence, but is online, I believe. Shelley, are you with us?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah. Thank you for joining us. Please turn off your cell phones if you have them. We have one item on the calendar today, that being House Bill 4002, Insurance for Dependents of Deceased Firefighters and Police. To present the bill, we have Deputy Commissioner John Boucher and several of his staff that he will introduce as he brings them online. Thanks for joining us today, and you have our undivided attention.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is John Boucher. I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Administration. Joining me at the table today on my left is Chief Pension Officer Michelle Michaud from the Department of Administration's Division of Retirement and Benefits. And on my right is Joan Wilkerson. She is the Assistant Attorney General who's been supporting the department in the drafting and development of HB 4002. So, if we can just go to page one of the presentation, and first of all, I want to kind of make some overarching statements, kind of, you know, why are we here and why has this bill made the call of the special session? And really, I think the answer to that is, as you're aware, there have been some high-profile deaths among individuals who have served the state of Alaska in a protective services capacity during the last several years. And this bill is about addressing that gap, the gap in benefits that really was identified by these situations and highlighted in the course of that. And so the administration, in following up an effort that was led by a member of the House, is introducing this bill that attempts to provide premium-free medical coverage to families of peace officers and firefighters who were killed in the line of duty. So that is the goal of our legislation. So why do we have this? And I'll try to go through, identify some issues here. Please feel free to interrupt with questions if you have them as we go. But the issue number one is that surviving spouses or dependents are not eligible for premium-free medical coverage until that survivor becomes eligible for those benefits at retirement age. So when you have a situation where an individual is killed in the line of duty, their surviving spouses and dependents in certain instances are not eligible until almost until the age of 60. And so you have a gap in coverage there for those individuals.
Excuse me for we've been joined by Representative Cherise Millett, who is the person that got the ball rolling on this and had the first bill. And if you would care to join us at the table, Cherise, you're welcome to.
So, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So our solution here is to craft a bill that allows these surviving spouses and dependents to start premium-free medical care upon the instance of an occupational death of a peace officer or firefighter. Now, we have, as you know, we have multiple tiers in our retirement system, and the instance that we're talking about solving here with issue number one is primarily what is referred to as our Tier 2 and Tier 3 PERS, peace officers and firefighters. We have a different health plan and health situation for those who belong to Tier 4, or what's referred to as the defined contribution plan. In that plan, you currently cannot access health care at the time the deceased member until they would have reached 25 years of service, and at that time the health care plan can only be accessed by a full paid premium by the individual. And so how this particular bill addresses that is it allows 100% premium paid by the state for the surviving spouses or dependents of peace officers and firefighters only upon the instance of an occupational death. Now, you may be familiar with our Tier 4 plan in that it is a premium share plan. In other words, depending on how many years of service you can, the member contributes a certain portion of the total premium for the plan. What happens in the instance of this peace officer, firefighter, occupational death for the survivor is that they receive the premium they receive the benefit premium-free until they reach Medicare age, and then at Medicare age, they begin to contribute to the premium based upon the years of service. So, a third issue that we identified is that in this DCR plan or the Tier 4 plan, that it is a requirement to receive both the retirement benefit and the health benefit to retire directly from the plan. And what that means is that you have to have worked the 12 months prior to your retirement in the system. And so in an instance where a DCR member works, say, 5 or 10 years and then is killed in the line of duty, and then their dependent continues to receive an occupational benefit, but they cannot retire directly from the plan. And so this was really a technical fix that had to occur for these people because it was really impossible for them to retire directly from the plan. And then issue four is what I would describe as a cleanup issue that affects all tiers that we identified for fixing in this, is that in the process of doing it, this is that the benefits or health benefits are not available to dependent children of PERS plan members if the member dies and there is no surviving spouse. And so you may have an instance of a single parent. And so what this particular facet of the legislation attempts to do is to allow access to those medical benefits that individuals are entitled, that the dependents would be entitled to in the cases where there is no surviving spouse. So you might wonder, okay, how and who is covered? When we say peace officers and firefighters, what does that mean? And there is a statutory definition that defines who peace officers and firefighters do. And I just draw your attention to the fourth bullet on the bottom of the page. So this includes peace officers, fire, police, chief of police, correctional officers, a regional public safety officer, correctional superintendents, firefighters, and fire chiefs. So these are the individual occupations that are covered under this particular bill. It is a subset of PERS that is referred to by the name of peace fire. And to give you an idea of the size of the demographic group, it's about 3,600 total members. About 1,900 of those are state, and about a little over 1,700 are spread across the political subdivisions. And I know the handout says 150 political subdivisions, but actually there are 43 political subdivisions that have peace officers or firefighters.
Mr. Chair? Yeah, just for the record, through the chair, Mr. Boucher, so in municipalities, other non-state law enforcement firefighters, are they required to be in PERS as a matter of law if they're employed in municipal, or they can opt out and go to other? The Teamsters Union has Wasilla police officers, and they may have dual representation. They may have been in PERS and then opted for another labor organization, but are you aware of other? Can you kind of give us any information on that issue? Do we need somebody else to? Are they required, or is it optional, or are they dually covered and represented for some of them?
Through the chair, Representative Culver, this is not a high area of my expertise. I'm aware, for instance, of volunteer and contract firefighters that do not have a relationship with PERS. But I'd have to research whether or not it's a requirement.
I'm sorry, this is Michelle Michaud, Chief Health Official for Division of Retirement Benefits. So the different municipalities and political subdivisions do have the option to elect to participate in PERS. And as part of that election, they can choose to exclude certain classes of employees. So they could choose to exclude their peace officer firefighters from participation in PERS.
Okay. Just thought, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure many of us represent areas that have a lot of volunteer firefighting departments. And they have some of their employees, depending on the number of hours worked, whether or not they're in the PERS system or not, and there's been some issues, how many hours you could work before you were considered eligible for PERS. So be good to clarify the record. If they're volunteer firefighters or EMS, and would this classification cover EMS workers, so ambulance workers, if they got in an auto accident, for instance, on the or at a scene of a crime. So what do we have out there as far as who's covered, who's not covered? That's a municipal firefighter, either volunteer, and at what point do they enter into the PERS system and then would be covered? Because I think we're going to have some covered, some not covered, and I think it would be real good to have the record clear on what the intent of the legislation is as drafted.
Okay. We can do that.
Thank you.
I think that what had probably started this conversation with Representative Culver was there was a bill out last year that I believe we have three service areas up in the interior that are all on contract. They all have a contract with a private firm, and they have opted out of PERS, TERS, and everything else, and they have their retirement program. They have medical. They have the whole nine yards. And I believe there might have even been more than the original three around the state, but there are entities in the state that are doing it on a private basis.
Right.
Well, Mr. Chair, in Mattsu, there was recently some litigation from, I guess, firefighters and EMS volunteers. The borough was trying to limit the amount of time they put in so they wouldn't trigger into the PERS system. They reached a kind of a consent agreement. They had litigated on saying that, well, we should have been covered by PERS, and we weren't. So there is definitely, there's some of them that are full-time. There's some folks that are first responders that only are allowed to work, I think, 20-some hours a week before they, so they don't trigger into that PERS system. So that's an issue that probably needs to be identified. Who's going to get coverage under this provision in our municipal volunteer fire departments, and who's not going to be covered, so that it's pretty clear that what the expectations are, and those that are eligible would get coverage. Obviously, retirement benefits doesn't delve into these municipal departments that much, but I know that's the case. Mattsu has huge fire departments, and it's generally most of the staff are part-time because of the PERS issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other question, Mr. Chair, is EMS. Is the statutory definition cover ambulance drivers, for instance? Because in Anchorage, I think they cross-train and they do both. They work as a firefighter and as an EMS crew for their professional department. So just want to make sure that that works. The record's clear on that, or that area needs adjustment at some point.
Through the chair, Representative Calder, the intent of the bill is to limit it to employees who have an existing relationship with the PERS system. And so while I don't know the details of individual fire departments or employees or even categories of employees, if there is no pre-existing relationship with PERS, they would not be covered. So the intent is to, you have to have that existing relationship with PERS, which based on the comments from Ms. Michaud would essentially be determined by the participation agreement between the state and the political subdivision.
So let me ask you a question. What happens under the current system if someone isn't killed in the line of duty, but is disabled to the extent that they can no longer work?
Good question.
In the current system?
In the current system.
If, excuse me, Representative Ledoux through the chair, the answer to that question is PERS has an occupational death and disability benefit. And so they could receive a disability benefit.
May I follow up on that, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Through the chair, Mr. Boucher, I have a bill that I filed. We have had it last, the 28th legislature as well. An officer came to me, member of the Anchorage Police Department, noted that if he were injured grievously, for example, or his colleague, they would receive no retirement benefits during their convalescence. I mean, presumably if they were moved to a desk assignment or something, they would be. But if they were truly convalescing in a hospital or at home, their retirement benefits would be frozen during that time. They would be covered by workers' compensation and nothing else. And I have a bill that was intended to cure that, because I think it's bad policy to not cover them. But am I right, and this is sort of a follow-up on Representative Ledoux's comment, that my bill, if it says what I say it says, would indeed cover this gap where there'd be no retirement coverage? Do you share that understanding?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I can't say that I don't. I do not know about the workers' comp. I'll look to my colleagues.
I think that'll be a Kathy Lee. We'll have to follow up.
Okay. We'll have to follow up with you on that question.
John, do you know offhand how many bargaining units we have that cover these people?
Through the state?
Yeah.
The correctional officers, peace, fire, or excuse me, the PSEA, the troopers. Represent the wildlife troopers represented by PSEA?
I'm not sure, nor the airport safety officers. Yeah. I'm not sure what they call them.
Yeah. Those are the two that come to mind right away, but I'll have to get the full.
And do they have optional coverages that are part of their package that the employees can choose from?
To the chair, yes. From my understanding, PSEA has some.
So that could be accidental death and disability or
yes.
Assisted care or whatever.
To the chair, yes, we have a suite of voluntary insurance benefits now for that has actually grown during the past year. Previously, for instance, the life insurance limit was somewhere in the neighborhood of $48,000, but now it's a higher limit for all Alaska care members and those who have access to SBS.
By the next meeting, could we get copies of the current contracts and the ones that they replaced?
Certainly.
Thanks. Representative Ledoux?
Just following up on my original question there. So somebody's grievously injured and isn't able to go back to work, what happens to them and their dependents under the current system? That's kind of what I'm trying to figure out. Mm-hmm. As far as their health insurance benefits. Do they have to pay for their health insurance benefits then? Are they terminated from their health insurance benefits if they're no longer they're working? What happens to them?
Michelle, can you help me with that?
through the chair, Representative Ledoux. It is my understanding that if they are appointed to a disability benefit under the PERS system, that they are entitled to health insurance for themselves and their eligible dependents, at least in the Tier 2 and Tier 3 plans. I will follow up with the Chief Pension Officer to find out if that is correct and if that also applies to the Tier 4, and I'll get back to you.
Thank you.
Please continue.
So I wanted to give the committee just kind of a brief history of how we got here. As you may be aware, Governor Parnell worked with legislators on HB 66 and SB 202, which that version of the bill contemplated covering all PERS and all TERS employees in this fashion. And also it removed the requirement for in the defined contribution retirement plan to retire directly from the plan. And so the combination of that provision as well as the amount of coverage that was offered resulted in a pretty significant fiscal note. And so it was thought that particularly in this current climate that we needed to narrow the focus of this particular bill. So there was an attempted revision of HB 66 to expand health insurance coverage under the group insurance statute, but unfortunately in the drafting of that, that particular vehicle would have excluded individuals who belong to health trusts, and so the troopers who were one of the primary motivating factors for doing this particular piece of legislation would not have been covered. And so late in the session, the Department of Law and Ledge Legal drafted a new version of the bill, which we have referred to as version S, but no hearings were held on that, and ultimately it came into SB 91 as an amendment, and that was approved. And but ultimately, that amendment was removed from SB 91, but it was introduced, essentially as part of the calendar is the special session. And so what we're dealing with here in essentially is the version S of HB 66 that was introduced near the end of the session.
And to help the people that are in the room and haven't been following this real closely, we first heard this bill almost a year and a half ago. We heard it without a fiscal note as a courtesy because it was time sensitive and without an actuarial review. The fiscal note that John is referring to, we just heard about yesterday, and that's why we didn't have any meetings in between then and now. The actuarial report we got about 3 weeks ago, but the $60 million fiscal note we did not hear about until yesterday. Yeah, which is why we didn't have any meetings during the interim, because we were waiting for fiscal note and the actuarial report. We have a second actuarial report that we got last night that I haven't had a chance to read, and I don't know if anybody else has, but I think the whole flavor of the bill has changed, and I think it's going to be more manageable this time around.
I guess I don't understand, and maybe there's somebody here from someplace who can explain a $60 million fiscal note. I mean, I understand over the past 10 years, maybe 27 people have died in the line of duty from all departments. I mean, how can it come up with $60 million fiscal note to cover 27 people? That just seems outlandish.
I can't answer because I haven't seen it. I only heard about it yesterday. But I think everybody probably agreed that there was something wrong with it. It may have included everybody in the state. Because I think there is still a question on whether this can only be applied to a portion of the state employees or all the state employees, or offered to them.
And Representative Ledoux, through the chair, as to answer, to follow up on the chairman's statement, the bill at that time contemplated covering all PERS and all TERS members, as well as dealing with this provision that was also a significant portion of the fiscal note, where individuals are in the DCR plan were not required to retire directly from the plan, which is was a significant portion of that overall cost. So it was additional issues as well as a larger scope that contributed to the size of that fiscal note. I don't recall the number, so I won't say that it was $60 million because I don't have it in front of me and I mix up numbers. But so I hope that at least helps explain some of the difference.
And I might like to add that that is not the fiscal note now. That was the fiscal note on the original version of the first bill that was not before us, but it was referred to in passing during the testimony.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Culver.
Well, the fiscal note we have included with the bill starts out FY17 at $174,000, and then out 5 years, $226,000 is forecast.
So we'll be getting to that. We'll be getting to that when we get. We'll do the sectional and the fiscal note.
Okay, good.
As soon as we get done with the overview.
I don't know how many years it would take to get $60 million of business.
Depends on how many bodies you have in there.
So our next slide, although, you know, we can cover the costs a little bit, that the fiscal note that we projected, as Representative Culver just previously indicated, starts with an anticipated cost of about $174,000, rising to $226,000 over the five-year period. You could expect that cost to incrementally grow over time, but it, of course, will depend on experience and what happens related to a number of assumptions, such as the cost of health care, providing health care, such as the experience that we have with those particular employees. I think if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, I'll just skip. I understand we're going to deal more in the actuarials in the next meeting. Is that?
Yeah, and if I could break in for a minute, I'd like to reflect that we've been joined by Representative Seaton and Representative Stutz. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
So since we're going to get into more detail, I propose then that we jump over the next slide into potential expansion, for instance. And this is more in the line of why did you take this particular approach? And for example, a potential expansion of the bill would be to, why aren't you including village public safety officers or the National Guard or other contractors who do similar work? And the issue here, which it is really related to the relationship that that individual has with the PERS system. If there is no existing relationship, we could violate IRS law by providing a benefit from the trust fund from which this individual has no membership. And so the worst consequence that could happen in that instance, of course, is that the plan would lose its tax-exempt status, and that would be very expensive for the employees as well as the state. So looking at a smaller scope, for instance, why, for instance, did you only limit this to, or why did you not limit this only to the troopers or to state employees? And the issue with that is that we would have to redefine who the peace officer firefighter group is. essentially what we have is a well-defined historical group called the peace officers and firefighters within our retirement system. And they have been offered a specific suite of benefits that have been different, really, from its inception from our all others. And so we believe, from a legal perspective and from a number of perspectives, that we're on the safest ground if we offer this benefit to that entire group. So if we, for instance, limited to just the troopers, we would be offering a subset of this PERS group, essentially an enhanced benefit, and that could require some significant changes to the PERS system, actuarial and legal analysis that would be associated with that. In other contexts, for instance, CalPERS, they have kind of taken this approach where essentially they're customizing benefits by groups or employers. And one of the significant challenges from an administrative point of view is that it becomes unmanageable with all of the flavors of benefits. So we could imagine opening this door and there being a hue and cry, well, for this group we should do this benefit, and for this municipality they would like this type of benefit. And so we have really avoided that simply because the administration could be extremely difficult in going forward. So as I said, some people have referred to ours as the Goldilocks solution because it's not, we've tried to make it not too big and not too small. We've tried to apply this particular benefit to an existing statutorily defined group of peace officers and firefighters, and it's consistent with the legal distinction of this group from other state employees. And the other benefit of doing this is that the fiscal impact is much smaller than it would have been had we offered it to a larger set of population. That really concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
And just for education of people that might not have been here 4 years ago, I think the first time this bill came into being, or a similar bill, the teachers, NEA, jumped right on board because there had been a couple of fatal shootings around the state of either teachers or principals. And that, I think, dropped off on 66. I think it may have been on the first version of the bill last January, and then it dropped off immediately. But there are arguments to be made by any number of classes of people that if you die on the job traumatically, that it, and again, by the out of the 27 fatalities that we found, a significant portion, almost half, was aircraft, either helicopters or fixed planes falling, and it hit any number of departments and divisions. Admin, I think, lost two people, and a head-on car crash. DOT's lost a number of people traumatically, avalanche, equipment falling, you name it. And I think we have to be cognizant of the fact that there are other entities that are going to want to be covered by this as well. It's just a matter of finding how we can do it the most efficiently. Representative Carver?
Efficiency. What do we have, a kind of a pro forma schedule, how we want to, you're going to manage this bill?
I would manage it as far as it takes to get it out of this committee, and then first off, it's not our bill, it's the governor's bill. And I've been meeting with the administration for several weeks, and I've volunteered to get it out of the first committee if at all possible, which I think is doable. I'm jumping ahead a little bit, but I think at the beginning of next week, The next group that we will hear from will be the actuary, the state risk manager, and again, probably a little more from Michelle on the inner workings of it. But today, my plan is to get through the bill and the sectional. And I think we'll probably hold off on the fiscal until we have the actuary online. I think that will probably be, you know, we can do it once and get into the minutia, or we can do it twice and not. But does that answer your question?
Yeah, and then maybe the Xerox actuarial, is that an old one, new one?
I believe the new one just came out a couple days ago. In fact,
yeah. 24th, okay. So that's the one we'll be going over.
That'll be the working document.
Okay, thank you.
And the only reason I brought up anything related to the previous bills is because it was brought up as part of the dialogue. But,
well, I think it's important.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I think everybody at the table does. And I'm guessing just about everybody in the room. But where do you want to start now? You want to go into the sectional or the bill? Let's go into the bill.
Okay.
And you can do it via the sectional if you'd like.
Okay. So if it pleases the chair, I'd like to have Ms. Michaud lead through the sectional.
Certainly.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So Michelle Michaud, Chief Health Official for Division of Retirement and Benefits. So I think John has covered a lot of this already, but the main direction that this bill was headed was to provide for survivors of peace officers and firefighters that were killed in the line of duty benefits where there are existing gaps in our medical coverage. So Section 1 first addresses the health reimbursement arrangement account. So that's the account that can be used to pay for part of the premium or to pay for other qualified medical expenses for the DCR members. And so what this amendment does to 39-3400B is it allows for the eligible member's dependent child to have access to those funds as well. So that just closed a gap we had there on the health reimbursement arrangement. Section 2 of the bill goes back to the defined benefit portion. So this is where Tier 2 and Tier 3, this removes the gap. So right now, if a peace officer or firefighter works 20 years of service, they are considered to have a normal retirement. But they have to work 25 years of peace officer or fire service to qualify for medical benefits. So if something happens to that member and they suffer an occupational death, then there is a gap where there is no coverage provided. So the occupational death benefits would go until normal retirement, which is with the 20 years, but they would never get to the 25 years needed to qualify for the medical benefits. So this provision closes that gap, and it also allows for, again, the dependents to be covered when there's no surviving spouse, which was a gap that we have in all of our tiers, that if it was a single parent, the dependent child did not have the ability to have medical coverage under the retirement plan. So that closed that as well. Section 3 allows for that gap to be closed with it being premium free. So currently that gap they do have in the defined benefit plan, they do have access to the medical benefits, at least the spouse does, but they would have had to pay 100% of the premium for those benefits. So Section 3 provides for that benefit to be given to them premium free.
Thank you. Just so I'm clear about this, if a non-public safety officer, peace officer, a clerk one, mm-hmm. was a single parent and died, then there would be no coverage for dependents under current law. I think that's pretty clear.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, that's correct. If there was no surviving spouse and a non-peace fire passed away due to occupational reasons, there would not be access to the medical plan for that dependent child.
All right. And follow up. But if they did have a surviving spouse, there would be coverage?
The surviving spouse would be able to cover that dependent, yes.
With payment by the surviving spouse of of something like a COBRA payment, or?
Correct. I'm sorry, Representative Justice, through the chair. That is correct, that they would have to pay for that coverage until the survivor either reached age 60 or the member would have reached normal retirement. So in the all other category, normal retirement can be with 30 years of service. And so when you're appointed to an occupational death benefit, that service continues to accrue. So if it would be whichever came first, whether the survivor reached age 60 or the member, had they survived, reached 30 years of service, at that time the survivor would become eligible for premium-free medical benefits. But up until that time, they would have to pay the premium.
Yeah, thank you. So we do distinguish, it's an advantageous position, even though you have to pay some sort of premium to enjoy the benefit, it's advantageous to be a married person who is a widow or widower. I mean, we make that distinction. We prejudice, in effect, single parents to some degree under the existing law. Is that fair?
There is a disadvantage for a child when there's no surviving spouse, yes. For a dependent child.
Okay.
Representative Guido, followed by Representative Pulver.
Thank you. I'm not directly related to this, but I was thinking down the road, perhaps if there's a survivor, that survivor receives another job someplace where they are then receiving or eligible to receive benefits under the existing plan or under the proposed plan. Does that survivor then transition their health care to that new plan, or are they continuing to be eligible to receive this benefit from the state?
Representative Keto, through the chair. When a survivor is appointed to a benefit, if they're not eligible for premium-free, they do have the opportunity to elect to pay for that coverage. They can then drop that coverage if they get coverage through another employment. And then when the survivor would turn 60 and become eligible for premium-free, they'd be given the opportunity to re-enroll in the plan. If they still have that other coverage and it was an active coverage, coordination of benefit rules kick in. And at that point, the employee plan would pay as primary and the retiree plan would pick up as secondary.
And as a follow-up, I guess I'm thinking, would they be able to elect, or would they be required if they had the ability to have another plan? So if that individual went to work in a state position where they would be eligible for a benefit where they'd have to pay a premium, would that be an election to pay the work-related benefit, or would they continue to be allowed to receive the survivor benefit?
So, Representative Keto, through the chair, currently state employees, at least in the Alaska Care Plan, and there are Union Health Trusts that have different rules, but in the Alaska Care Plan, it is required that they participate at least in some level of the medical coverage if they're in a medical benefit eligible position. There is currently an option where there is a premium-free option, so they although they would have to elect a coverage, they could elect a premium-free coverage.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
Representative Palmer, followed by Representative
Liddell. Yeah, so the way I understand this revised section is if under the provision that, what you say on line 25, page 2, if he's receiving a benefit under A3 of this section, which on the previous page references deceased members who are peace officers and the dependent children surviving spouse, this simply gives them the option just to like pay like a COBRA up to the point that where they would receive statutory benefits as a survivor of the employee, like you said, at 60, depending on the number of years of service in the plan, as an option to Section 11, which is that the state will cover the premium at no cost to the surviving spouse, dependent children.
Representative Culver, through the chair. I'm not sure I understand the question, so you might have to correct me.
You have two options here is what I'm saying. This is an elective for the surviving spouse to pay the premium to keep the insurance in force as an option. And then there's also later on in the bill, I believe it's Section 11, that the premium will be covered by the state of Alaska or the retirement system.
Okay. Representative Culver, through the chair, there's the page one, which is amending, which is the 400B, that's the health reimbursement arrangement account, that does tie to the defined contribution retirement plan. And under Section 11, it would allow for the dependent to receive premium-free medical if there was no surviving spouse or if there was a surviving spouse until the surviving spouse reached Medicare age, and then at which case then the premium subsidy piece of the statutes would come into play, where depending on their years of service, so if they had 25 years of service, they would have to pay 15% of the premium. And the health reimbursement arrangement account that falls under the 400B statute could be used to pay that 15%. So it does give them the option once they are eligible for the premium subsidy or convert to the premium subsidy other than 100%, to use that to pay those premiums.
Okay. If we were going, Mr. Chair, if we were going to explain it, we could do some boxes and flow charts and have some arrows come around. Well, this would cover the uncovered portion that Medicare didn't pay for.
Not necessarily, sorry, Representative Culver, through the chair, not necessarily the Medicare portion, but the premium for the DCR retiree plan.
Okay.
We'll just say it's $1,000. I have no idea what the premium will be. But well, if it was $1,000 and they had to pay $150 of that premium, they had to pay 15%, that HRA, that health reimbursement arrangement account, could be used to pay that $150 each month.
Okay, thank you.
So under the current system, if there's no surviving spouse, the kids are simply up the creek, right?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, currently the statutes do not provide access to the medical plan for those dependents if there is no surviving spouse.
So we're fixing this for the surviving children of peace officers. Are we fixing this for everybody else too?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, under the current version of this bill, no, it does not fix it for everybody else. It would be limited to peace officer and firefighters killed in the line of duty.
Follow-up? So could we fix it for everyone else's, the children of everybody else? Because I can't believe that anybody purposely did things this way. I mean, it just sounds so absolutely screwy. Without providing this additional benefit that we're going to provide for peace officers.
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we could, if we amended this, we would have to run another actuarial analysis to see if there was additional cost associated with that change. But yes, it could be changed.
Could you do that? Could you run that additional actuarial analysis? Is it, to me, it sounds nuts that you wouldn't provide for the kids simply because the spouse is not alive. I mean, the kids are going to be in a worse situation, you know, if they don't have either parent than they would be if they were left with one parent.
Yes, Representative Ledoux, through the chair, we can certainly ask the actuaries to run some numbers on that.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
We may have a legal opinion coming that addresses it from a different angle as well. At least one, I'm thinking. Representative Hedo, followed by Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the things to think about maybe is perhaps communication with the Department of Health and Social Services. I believe if there's no surviving spouse, the children become wards of the state, and then they're eligible for Denali Kid Care, so there is health care coverage provided, so the children are covered in a different way, just not directly through the health care, but that might be something worth checking with DHSS.
Again.
Well, yes, through the chair, and this is more, I suppose, a statement than a question, but I think the policy call that's made is that we want to encourage people to enter careers in public safety. We need them. This is cheaper than the $50 million version. But I have to say that what you've identified and what Representative Ledoux and I have talked about sounds, in the law, I think the word is invidious. It's sort of arbitrary and capricious. I don't really know what the policy call is to say single parents' children won't get something that married parents' children will get. I just don't know what the policy call, other than a savings. It's not a discrimination based on race, creed, or color phenomenon where there's a suspect class, but in the constitutional law, you'd say, well, what's the rational basis for this? I'm somewhat satisfied by what Representative Keto said, but I'd be interested in knowing about that.
Representative Josephson's point, is there any difference in the way significant others are treated as spouses are treated?
Mr. Chair, we recently did, with a recent court ruling, we did change the provisions so that there's only a very small subset of qualified same-sex partners that were grandfathered, new qualified same-sex partners, because they do have the legal right to get married or no longer given access to the plan. But there is a small handful of existing retirees that had qualified same-sex partners that have been grandfathered under that provision.
Could you get a copy of that to Conrad and Hill disperse into the committee, please? Who's next? Please continue.
Okay. So I believe we're on Section 4. So Section 4 expands basically to include the spouses and dependents of peace officers and firefighters, the coverage under the defined contribution retirement plan. So previously the statute limited it to a surviving spouse of a member who had already retired or was eligible to retire at the time of their death. So this makes it more expansive to allow for those spouses and dependents of the fallen peace officers and firefighters immediately upon their death. Section 5, again, in order, since we're broadening that to allow the spouses and dependents, we had to clean up the language from the member to the person to allow for those spouses and dependents to make the election. Section 6, this was just to clarify the previous version of the statute allowed for an irrevocable election to participate or not to participate, and since we allow people, once they participate, to cease coverage at some point, this clarified that language to be they just have to make an election not to participate by the time they're age 70 and a half, and if they make an election to participate, it is not irrevocable. Section 7, because this benefit was not, this is, again, in the defined contribution retirement plan, and just to give it some context, if a defined contribution retiree had 5 years of service and died, their service continues to accrue while the survivor is receiving an occupational death benefit. And so from that 5 years until 25 years is when they would be, that the survivor and the dependent child would not have any access to health care. So at that 25-year mark, they'd have access to health care, but they'd have to pay 100% of the premium until they reach Medicare age. So what this section of the bill does is, because this benefit was not previously available, and we've expanded the time, it sets for if the dependent child, for example, ages out in that period, they don't get the coverage for the entire duration. It just sets for an end date, allows for an end date. Okay. Section 8. So Section 8 largely does the same thing. It cleans up to allow for it used to be the retiree, the statute said who the retiree could cover. Well, since we're expanding this benefit now to be a surviving spouse or to a dependent child, it expands that definition to allow for those people to be covered as well. Section 9, so this expands the end date again. and so that it doesn't conflict, so that, again, if a child ages out in this interim period of time, they would not continue to have coverage. Section 10 it changes from a member to a person so that it can incorporate the dependent child if there was no surviving spouse for them to be covered. Section 11 provides for the survivor dependent child, eligible dependent child, to have this coverage premium free until the survivor would have reached Medicare age. And then again, at Medicare age, it converts back to the normal premium subsidy. Section 12 removes a reference to the occupational death benefit, where it converts to normal retirement because that's already cared for elsewhere in the plan or in the bill. So it was redundant with the other changes that were made. And then Section 13 repeals 880C, which was incorporated into 880B, so it was no longer necessary, was reenacted under 880C. So, it adds a new section to allow us to adopt regulations under Section 14. Section 15 provides for the benefit to be retroactive to January 1 of 2013. With certain provisions, Section 16 allows that Section 14, which is the ability to adopt regulations, that becomes effective immediately after this becomes law. And then Section 17 of the bill provides an exception to the adoptions. Well, again, it sets the effective date of that to any regulations to be January 1, 2017.
So. Why January 1st, 2013?
Do you want
to? Mr. Chairman, that would make certain that we cover the events that we discussed earlier in the meeting related to
so
the high prevalence of
instances of fatality or something like that, or
it's the year of that fatality.
Representative
Wilson, on that question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dempster, would the other families of the decedents, would they be able to enter into this? Or is it all entirely prospective after January 1, 2013? So, for example, there was a vehicle crash on November 24, 2012. There was one dependent spouse, no children. Would that spouse be eligible for health care?
If the incident occurred prior to January 1, 2013, they would not, but in that instance, they may not have been a member of the peace fire class anyway. Recall that this so the net, so to speak, is peace fire after January 1, 2013.
Okay, thank you.
So there would be two qualifiers to the list that I believe you're looking at.
Okay, thanks.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that is the end of the sectional analysis and the end of our presentation for today, unless you have any further questions.
We'll
certainly entertain them.
Representative Colbert.
Good.
You gave us a lot to digest. It's my intent to have next meeting early in the week, and we will have it noticed. As soon as we get committee rooms straightened out by mid-afternoon, we'll have it up and posted, and With that, seeing no other business before the committee, unless anybody has any comments, going once, going twice, we'll adjourn.